First, I would like to show you what is the problem of verified integration of ODEs, even though most of the audience will know this by heart. Then I will shortly show you Taylor model, the method for a problem, discuss the ripping effect, and finally the blunting method. So when we have an interval initial value problem, we have a usual ordinary differential equation, but the initial value is not a real number but or a real vector, but an interval which accounts for uncertainty in the initial conditions. And we are looking for a solution in some time interval. We assume that f is sufficiently smooth, such that derivatives that we need all are existing, and that we are looking for a solution at some time t n, which is greater than t0. So typically, the flow of an ODE may look like this. And when we start with several initial conditions, the solutions may diverge like they do in this picture. So basically, this is a difficult problem. Now, when you look at some initial set, say this initial interval, and you try to capture all solutions that start in this initial interval, then you have to follow the flow of this initial set. And after some time t1, the set may look like this. And after another time step, it may look like this. And what you see here is that while you start with an interval, you do not end up with an interval. And so this set changes structure. Let's look at it at another other level. Yeah? After the first time step, your interval has transformed. And to continue the integration, you would have to enclose it in an interval method, again in an interval. So in the second time step, you start with the Brown set. This has been increased. It's bigger than the true flow. And again, it's being transformed, and you would enclose it into another interval. So all the way, you pick up additional solutions, and this is what is usually called the wrapping effect. So while you would be satisfied with this blue set at this time step, what you end up with in a basic interval method would be the black set, which is much bigger. So convex sets that have been used to enclose the flow were started with Moore's pioneering work in the 60s. He used intervals. Eigenrahm and Lohner proposed parallelepipeds. Kuhn used sonotopes. But the main disadvantage of all these sets is that they are convex. And if the flow is not a convex set any longer, then you have overestimation that you cannot avoid. For nonlinear ODEs, in my opinion, one of the main reasons why Taylor models are so successful is that they can handle non-convex sets. Now, let us return to the interval methods to a very basic problem. Suppose we have the solution at some point tj, and we represent it by a point approximation, by something that accounts for the global error here. And this looks maybe a bit complicated on the first slide, but it will be much clearer on the following slides. So we have a representation with two interval with three interval vectors here, and with three real vectors here, and one interval vector here, which here this is our error term. Now, the first two terms here are an approximation to the point solution that we want to trace. This is a bound on the global error, and initially we start with the midpoint of the interval being u0. Global error is 0, and we start with the identity matrix for the S and for the B matrix. Now, for a simple model problem, constant coefficients linear ODE, this is said as it is the only thing that we really can analyze nowadays. The Taylor method simply looks like this. We have an interval, we have a vector iteration uj, the solution at the point tj is simply t times uj minus 1, where t is polynomial which tends to the exponential function of the matrix here. For an interval method, nothing much changes, except that we would account for the truncation error. So we care for the local error that comes from truncating here this Taylor series. Now geometrically, what we do is that we propagate the error by this interval vector iteration. So we have a set of a product of three matrices, TVJ minus 1 in the previous steps. This is to be found in the J's step. So this is our degree of freedom that we have, the choice of the matrix BJ. And these are the local errors here that occur in each time step. So what we are looking for is a matrix BJ such that this set here, which is a matrix vector product plus a vector, is contained in a matrix vector product. So this matrix vector product here may be denoted by this parallelepiped. You have to add the local error. This is the Z. And you end up with a set that looks like this. So you add this error term, let suppose the center here is zero. You add this and you end up with this set. Now you would like to enclose this again into a parallelepiped, which may look like this one. And then you see that here you get additional area. So this is again the wrapping effect. And depending on the layout of your parallelepiped that you use for enclosure, you have different way of wrapping. So how is the global error propagated? In the direct method as proposed by Moore, the BJs were simply the identity matrix. And we see in a while why this is not a very good choice. Then in the parallelepiped method, the BJs were chosen such that they are T times BJ minus 1. And again, we will see shortly why this is sometimes not a good choice. Lona's QR method proposed in 87 uses a QR factorization of TBJ minus 1. So you do this QR factorization and then you use BJ equals to QJ, which is the Q matrix of this QR factorization. And the blunting method that we want to analyze later is combining the TBJ minus 1 here with some portion of the QJ matrix out of the QR factorization. So when you look at the direct method, so this is the propagation of the global error. Now if you insert BJ equals the identity matrix, then you simply end up with this iteration. So what you see here is that this coordinate system is optimal for the local error. The local error is untouched, but the local error is the small part, whereas the global error is the big part, and this one is touched by the matrix T, and in case of a rotation, this is a very bad coordinate system for the global error then, as you can, for example, see in these slides. So when we start with this interval, initial set, if this set is rotated so that the flow is then this set, you have to enclose it into an interval that with the axis, and you see that you have huge overestimation in here. And the second time step in this case would be, this is the original set of the flow that you would like to enclose. This is the enclosure of the propagation of the first set, enclosure set, and then you would enclose this into an even bigger interval. And so it goes on like this. So after some time steps, while the set you are enclosed in is just a small segment of a line as it looks, you get this huge enclosure set. So for rotations, this method usually has huge overestimation. Now, when you do the parallelepiped method, short the P method here, you use T times BJ minus 1. Now then, in this case, this product cancels out to identity, So this looks like the optimal coordinate system for the global era. But it does not look like a very good coordinate system here. Now, the global era is the big part. So optimal coordinates for the global era seem to be a good idea, the first thing. And this is usually much smaller than this term. But if the t to the j's, if this condition number is not small any longer, then you have huge overestimation here, and then the method breaks down. Unfortunately, in the presence of shear, Tj becomes singular if j tends to infinity, and this is the regular case, so this method breaks down more often than not, even though it seems very good at the beginning of the iteration. So again, pictures here. You would have to enclose the blue, I think it's a light blue here, the light blue set. So when the condition number of the matrix T is small, you end up with small additions in the corner. But when the condition number is bigger, then these small triangles here become sharp spikes, and then you have a lot of overestimation here. What does the QR method do? Well, if you look at the QR method and plug in the Q matrix here, then you see that the error is propagated with the right upper triangular matrix that comes from the QR method here. And the local errors are simply propagated by an orthogonal matrix. So this is fine for the local errors, and it may be good for the global error, so it's not as good as the parallelly piped method. In fact, Kuhn has shown a numerical example for exponential overestimation for this method as well. But still, so far this is the best interval method that we know of, and it is able to handle rotation, contraction, and shear. What will you have here is, again, we would like to enclose the blue set. So you have two choices for rectangles to enclose this. You could use either this rectangle, or you could use this rectangle, and in this picture it's obvious which is the better thing to choose. So what you usually have to do is you have to orthogonalize along longest edges of your set that you would like to enclose. So what makes the QR method really work is introducing also permutation matrices to permute the columns of the matrix A with respect to length. And then this method can be really effective. Now, the blunting method uses the parallelly piped matrix plus a small portion of the orthogonal part of the QR factorization. Coordinates for the global error sometimes are better than for the QR method, but are they sometimes worse? Well, I can show you one example for this. I have prepared a small MAPLE worksheet, and the problem that we are tracing is we have the matrix T equals cosine phi minus sine phi sine phi and cosine phi. Now this would be a pure rotation, but if we put a 0.7 here, then it's also contraction in some parts, so we have shear. And if you look at this line, for B equals C, we have the parallelly piped method. So just let it run with the parallelly piped method. Takes a little while. What we see here is the initial set, and we propagate it, and it starts okay, that was it. So we can see it again, let's say The parallelly pipette method here works fine, and you see, look at the scale, it ends with a 6 here. Now if you use the same example with the QR method, things even improve, so we have a 3 here now. But that doesn't matter so much because the area is not much different and the enclosures now look like this. But if we use the blunting method here, then what you see is that now the scale goes up to 40, and so do the enclosures. So this is much worse than both of the parallelepiped and the QR method. Now the reason for this is that with addition of matrices, you do not know what happens to the condition number. It may become worse. So this is one of the reasons why I think this method is difficult to analyze, because you have a sum of two matrices, and this is much more difficult to analyze than a product of matrices, for example. So still we have here suitable coordinates for the local error, and basically this method also handles rotation, contraction, and shear. As you can see in these two pictures, the blunting method from a geometric viewpoint lies between the QR method and the parallelepiped method, which is no surprise since it is a sort of a linear combination of these two methods. So for small blunting factors, the red line belongs to blunting factor 10 to the minus 3. For small blunting factors, it looks like the parallelepiped method. And for bigger blunting factors, this is 0.5, it looks like the QR method. So you would have this enclosure. And again, you can see the same thing here, the same phenomenon. For a small blunting factor of 10 to the minus 3, it looks like the parallelepiped method with these sharp spikes. And for a larger blunting factor of 0.5, it almost looks like the QR enclosure. So what can be said about the propagation of the global error? This analysis here is mostly due to Ned and to Ken. For the global error in this interval vector iteration, we have the width of this given by the absolute value of this matrix times the width of the previous global error plus this usually small term. So what Ned and Ken showed in 2001 is that the error propagation tends of the spatial vector of the spectral radius of this matrix HJ, which is the product of these matrices that you find here. For the QR method, the BJs are the Qs here. So for the blunting method, the error propagation depends on the spectral radius of this matrix. Now the question is, how are the matrices HJ and PJ related? What can be shown is that in the case that T has eigenvalues of distinct magnitudes, then the QR method, in the QR method, the matrix HJ tends to the diagonal of this matrix tends to the powers of the eigenvalues. And for the blunting method, the diagonal of the matrix PJ tends to the powers of the eigenvalues multiplied by some factors denoted by alpha. And these alpha values can be bounded below and above by epsilon over 1 plus epsilon or 1 plus 1 over epsilon, where epsilon is the blunting factor. So if epsilon is 10 to the minus 3, we have that alpha k is between 10 to the minus 3 and 10 to the plus 3, 1000. For epsilon equal to 1, we have 0.5 to 2. And at least in this case, you can say that this diagonal behaves like this diagonal. So we have a similar error propagation in the case that these numbers alpha k are close to 1. This is one positive result that you can have here. You can also analyze the condition number of the BJs. In the Blunting method, you can write the BJs as a product of QJ times VJ, and what you can show is these estimates that you find here. So the one norm in the for the VJ inverse is bounded above by this expression, which for 10 to the minus 3 gives you quite a large number. So the question is this really useful? But for epsilon equal to 1, you see that then these matrices are well behaved and everything looks fine. There are lots of open problems and so far few answers. First problem is, what is the optimal choice of Blunting factor? I mean, an obvious generalization would be to replace the constant value epsilon by a diagonal matrix of several values of epsilon and then try to optimize these. I think that there is an answer to this, maybe, because you can think of expensive schemes in linear algebra, because usually you do not have larger dimensions than 6 or 8 for these methods, because for higher dimensions they do not work anyway. So it may be, I think it will pay off if you analyze this and look for a good heuristic how to choose these, even if it's expensive on the linear algebra side. The second point is the quality of the upper bounds for the condition of the BJs. Those were these numbers. How accurate are they? Well, even if they may be sharp in the worst case, I don't think they are of so much practical importance here, because a worst case scenario is not so likely to happen. Now, what is about an analysis of T with eigenvalues of the same magnitude? Well, this probably also can be done by trying to use continuity arguments. And again, the question is how relevant is these for practical examples here. But what really I think is a hard nut to crack is the column permutations of BJ, because when you do column permutations, you change the spectrum. And so the analysis that has been given by Ned and by Ken may not go through this. And on the other hand, as we learned, is that column permutations are really important in the QR method. You need them to get good enclosures. So you have somehow to find a way to analyze these column permutations when you want to analyze the Blunting method satisfyingly. Okay, that's it. So I thank you for your attention, and I'm open for questions or remarks.
Any questions? Would it also be an option to adapt the Blunting factor during the running of the algorithm? So choose a high value if the one is good.
Certainly. Certainly. This has sort of, wait a minute. This has been missing here. There should also be an index J. Yeah. So this is missing here. So you should choose new Blunting factors in each step. Yeah.
So maybe connected to this, so the way this happens in COSY, actually can answer some of these things. So first of all, the size of the Blunting factor depends on the ratio of the local error that you expect and the object that you want to transport. Okay, so if you have a point problem, you may want to use small Blunting factors, mm-hmm. and if you have a if you have to transport a range and you have tiny errors, you want to make a big one. Why? Because, as you pointed out, the spectral radius goes roughly with the condition number goes roughly with 1 over epsilon, and so when you send this error through the matrix, you get possibly an enhancement of the size of 1 over epsilon, mm-hmm. and you don't want to die from this, so you choose small epsilon if the error is relatively small compared to what you want to transport. So this answers one thing, and then the other thing is, so the way it's actually implemented, that the Blunting really is not on all the time, but only when the condition number of the P matrix goes below a certain bound.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because if obviously, when that is well conditioned, then you better leave the parallel P bit in place.
Sure, that would be choosing zero values.
Right. Yeah. So most likely, your example that you have there, in fact, we should look at your what was it? Not Maple.
It was a Maple example.
Maybe, yeah. So that is probably of such a kind.
It is. You have a huge local error in this example.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Right.
So this is not the usual scenario, of course.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so there you die from the combination of a small, from an unfavorable condition number,
mm-hmm.
and a bad ratio of local error to what you have currently accumulated.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So this is not very relevant in practice.
Yeah.
It's sort of a worst case scenario.
Yeah. Oh, but it's, or it's kind of interesting is this asymptotic that you have that for the small epsilon, if the two leading, if the one dominating eigenvector is sufficiently dominating, then the asymptotic is the same. There was that
this one
with a
yeah.
spectral radius.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Marcus, it's years since I looked at this in detail, but is there any, you were speaking about how you can't control what the condition number does when you add something to a matrix. Is there any possible mileage in a Blunting which is implemented by effectively multiplying by a matrix close to the identity?
But when you multiply with a matrix close to identity, you probably do not change the condition number of the matrix so very much, and so if you want to improve the condition number of nil-conditioned matrix, multiplying with a matrix close to the identity may not be sufficient. One can.
Yeah, but it's not going to make it work.
Yeah. Yeah, but the game is to improve it.
You add your epsilon b, then it does something else, which is good. And anyway, it's probably a rubbish idea.
John.
Yeah. Maybe another comment or question. So ultimately, all these attempts are directed at the question of how do you best add two parallel epipeds and contain it into a new one. That is really the underlying question here. And this
mm-hmm.
question is still largely unanswered. It's actually a great result, at least, that for the for the QR method. We have this nice asymptotic to the Blunting method. We have a similar thing, but for autonomous systems. But still, the question is, how do you optimally enclose these things? Do you want to minimize length, which is kind of what the QR method does? Do you want to minimize volume, which is more like what the initial stages of the parallel epipet method
mm-hmm.
do? And so this is a big question. So if anybody that if you should what we think about, and then whatever you do, do it so that it survives in the asymptotic case.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically that the blunting approach is just a very heuristic thing to take care of one issue, namely to avoid the condition number of the P matrix from getting too small.
Mm-hmm.
It's very heuristic, but is it optimal? Probably not. So how does one best do it? It's a big open question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have a few comments. I've done a lot of experiments with this. So optimizing the volume may not be a very good idea because it's easy to fool the method, because if you have this parallel pipe thing stretching one direction, the other one becomes very small, and the volume will end up smaller potentially. Yeah. You have large overestimation in one direction. But about the permutation matrices, they don't seem to make a difference in the constant coefficient case. I mean, this from hundreds of thousands of runs. They seem to make a difference if you have a nonlinear case, and not always a positive difference. So it's a real puzzle for me. So if I take a three-body problem, this permutation matrix is kind of hell, but if I take another problem, they may not. But I haven't seen in the constant coefficient case any significant difference based on many experiments in that way.
I had a question. So this is just a comment and a question. This may not help in the rigorous enclosure sense of really getting accurate control, but from a practical point of view, something like, you know, the way the simplex method works, if you really try to do the accurate thing in the worst possible case, it's terrible. But if you take typical things that occur in the real world, it seems to work very, very well. And there are theorems about random products of matrices and how they stabilize. And I wonder if anybody has ever tried to do this from a probabilistic point of view, where you look at typical orbits that you go at, not every orbit. Is there any study in that using these?
Not that I know of.
So this goes in the direction, you know, what happens in the nonlinear case and the non-autonomous case, so where basically your matrix that you apply depends on where you are,
mm-hmm.
and at what time. And so then, now, you know, however, even in a nonlinear case, they are still not really random. They are still, you know, your local matrices are roughly speaking the Jacobian of your local one step of the flow and so forth. So,
other questions?
Oh, actually, one comment I wanted to make. So, somehow, in many of these talks, it is always said that Moore did this direct method, and then Eigenrahm did this business with the moving coordinates. That's actually not true. If you look in Moore's book, he addresses this issue of rotating coordinate system. He just doesn't push it to the full extreme of the Eigenrahm case, but he gets actually fairly close.
He gets fairly close.
So one should give him credit for that. So the guy was smarter than you, make him look here.
Well, Eigenrahm does the same thing as Moore, except that here he starts when things get bad. But he has incredibly detailed analysis in his thesis, which is remarkable.
Yeah, no, that's clear, but. But for example, Moore also, I mean, basically what he forgot is he did not quite choose the optimal pole rotating coordinate system, but he just heuristically picked one. And it would actually be interesting to analyze the asymptotics of his behavior, especially for you guys who do this analysis all the time, to see what the original Moore method does. In fact, essentially what he does is he takes a few terms of that matrix series for the local step, and out of this he builds the new matrix. And it would be interesting. I would be interested to see, but my guess is it will not be.
So somebody after Moore showed that it was exponentially. There's another guy, L.W. Jackson, that showed that this grows exponentially in more space. I mean, there's a factor. Any other comments, questions? Oh, thanks, Marcus, again.